This is another iRaw podcast.
But informality, I find that to be helpful because informality doesn't just blur illegal legal. It doesn't just blur who is, you know, legitimate or a citizen and who is not. It doesn't just blur what is, you know, a permanent structure versus a temporary one. It doesn't just blur these sorts of binaries. It also, for me, I think it's really important, blurs the human and non-human as well.
So welcome back to The Animal Turn, everyone. I'm so happy that you're here with me today because I got to say this episode is awesome. My guest today is Yamini Narayanan, and she is just such a decisive, incredible thinker. And she offers really important insights into how we can think about animals and the urban. Our concept and focus today is informality, but it leads us to talking about a whole range of other related and super important concepts like mobilities. Yamini Narayanan is a senior lecturer in international and community development at Deakin University, where she also founded the Deakin Critical Animal Studies Network. Her work focuses on the nexus between animals and urban planning in India, as well as how speciesism, casteism, and racism intersect and enroll animals in nation-building projects. She has a forthcoming book, which is tentatively titled Mother Dairy, and it'll be one of the first empirical critiques of India's cow protectionism discourse and politics from a critical animals point of view, as she examines bovine realities both as sites of protection and as sites of production. Yamini has also published widely on the relationship between religion and cities in South Asia, including her 2015 book, Religion, Heritage, and the Sustainable City, Hinduism and Urbanization in Jaipur, and the edited volume in 2016 called Religion and Urbanism, Reconceptualizing Sustainable Cities in South Asia. I really do think that at some point in the future, I'm going to have to do a season on religion. It just seems to come up time and again. So many ideas for future seasons. Anyhow, Yamini has numerous journal articles and book chapters about urban animals. I really encourage you to read her stuff. It's fascinating and really well done. She also publishes widely in popular media on issues related to animal rights, including in places like Animal Liberation Currents, the Hindu Center for Politics and Public Policy, Huffington Post, and Animal People Forum. So I haven't got much more to add, except I think informality is an extremely useful concept for blurring some of the dichotomous ways in which we think about animals in the city. And it offers really just fruitful ways of thinking through many urban animals relationships. I don't know. There's just something really generative here. And when I was done speaking to Yamini, I just had to sit down and really think about how informality pertains to my own work. And I hope that you find it as exciting. So enjoy the show. Hello, Yamini. Welcome to The Animal Turn.
Thank you so much, Claudia, for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I think we've been emailing back and forth for a couple of months now.
Yes,
so
we have.
it's nice to talk to you about some of your papers. I've definitely read a couple of them. And I think when it comes to speaking about animals in the urban, pretty certain it's hard not to come across some of your work, especially your work on dogs and cows, which I'm hoping we'll talk a bit about today.
Yes, of course.
But before we get into the thick of everything, I always like to start the show with finding out a bit about you. So how did you come to being interested in animal studies and doing the work that you do?
Thank you so much, Claudia. My work previously focused on feminist urban planning. So it was always focused on how cities can be gender sensitive to the needs and vulnerabilities of women. So I always had my lens focused and trained, so to speak, on the most marginalized and those that live in the margins of urban spaces, so to speak, and urban consciousness and urban planning. And also my work has predominantly focused on Indian cities. So Indian city urban planning, for example, master planning doesn't even have a gender dimension to it. It doesn't even note the fact that women particularly have specific needs of cities, for example. So conceptually, my eyes were always trained and my mind was always thinking about those at the margins of the city, though it had not registered animals at all, even though animals are so visible so profusely across urban environments in India. But what happened was, it was actually during an interview with one of my female respondents that I actually even noticed the animal in the city. So a lot of Indian cities are, you know, especially older the parts of the city, you'll find this even more. And these are the informal spaces, actually, where they're not quite under the ambit of formal governance or formal urban governance. So what people have to do is try and create infrastructure on their own that is not necessarily authorized. So, for example, then you'll find if you look up, you'll find the tops of, you know, rooftops crisscrossed with wires because everyone's siphoning off electricity from where they can. And this is just because formal governance and formal urban planning doesn't provide these provisions and doesn't provide these infrastructures. So there was a woman who was talking about, you know, the constraints of living in certain urban spaces. And she said, she was giving me a list of all the problems and all the issues. And she said, and then you have the monkeys and the electrocuted monkeys. So what happens is that these wires are crisscrossed, crisscrossing naked, oftentimes naked electric live wires. And the spaces are full of monkeys. Now, monkey mobility is really interesting because they don't necessarily walk on the streets. They don't fly. It's almost architectural because they are attached to buildings, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You know, so monkey mobility can be it's quite interesting, but it can almost be described as architectural because they're leaping from building to building in the absence of trees. There's hardly any trees anymore, right? So these monkeys leap on the wires. And then they get electrocuted, and the lucky monkey dies. The unlucky monkey survives, right? The unlucky monkey survives electric burns, septicemia. They're susceptible to attacks from other monkeys, other, you know, dogs, humans, and they literally die of third-degree electric burns in the scorching summer heat of, you know, that most Indian cities have, right? I just couldn't get the burnt monkey out of my head. Like, I mean, she continued on. This woman continued on about, you know, I mean, she was, her worldview and her conversation was mainly anthropocentric. It was quite understandable in the sense that, you know, she was living in this hot environment and then the monkeys were disrupting electricity flows. Mm-hmm. And this was a daily occurrence almost, but I couldn't get the burnt monkey, the surviving burnt monkey out of my head. And I was like, who can I ask for? It took me 2 or 3 days until someone suggested to me, why don't you go to an animal shelter? So that's how removed from animal studies I was. Right. It didn't even occur to me that I should just go to an animal shelter or animal sanctuary to find out more about these monkeys. I was that removed from the animal question, as it were. And of course, like, that made instant sense. So I actually, you know, went to animal shelter in the city of Jaipur. It's called Help and Suffering. And I went there and there was this retired army official who was, you know, managing, who volunteering his time and managing the space. And he gave me a tour of the shelter. And he goes, it's not just the monkeys. And he showed me animal after animal after animal. And we're talking about extremely multi-species environments in India, right? So we're talking about, we're talking about camels who would come with broken nostrils because they would be carrying load. We were talking about cows who were roaming around, eating waste. 60 to 80 kilos of plastic. I mean, you know, cows have four stomachs. They're four stomach ruminants, right? And there's 60 to 80 kilos of plastic that they consume. Then you have dogs, you know, dogs who get crushed under, you know, motorized transportation, dogs with mange, cats. I mean, there was any number of birds with broken feathers because it was such an insight into how the urban environment is just so hostile to different animals and the kind of different vulnerabilities they face based on the kind of mobilities that is unique to that species.
Yeah.
So that was a real eye opener. So I guess that's how my entry into the animal urban question came through, was because, you know, it was through my previous work on feminist urban planning. And then it really just took over. From there on, I think there was no looking back. I almost went away from my previous research into this one.
Well, what were you doing right now? Was this during a master's or a PhD, or was this post-PhD? When were you kind of doing this?
This was just immediately post-PhD. So I was working on a new project at that point of time, and that was, I was focused on the old heritage spaces of Jaipur city. So I was focused on cities that have a medium-sized population, because Indian cities tend to be mega. you know, 10 million mm-hmm. plus is quite normal. So I was actually focused on cities that are kind of more manageable as a researcher to focus on. So they were about, you know, 4 to 5 million-ish range. And I was focused on the oldest parts of the cities that are not directly under the purview of formal governance and the unplanned, the more unplanned parts of the city.
What an incredible story. And I related in some ways. I think I was doing feminist research as well and gender studies, and that was my gateway into thinking about animals. And I think oftentimes it's because a lot of that research kind of challenges us to question the everyday. You know, what is the everyday? How do power dynamics work in everyday spaces? So really powerful stuff. And I love that you brought up, I mean, I love that how powerful it is to think through some of what informality is, the power cables, because I know even in, I think it's in the US, some of the biggest outages like that have crashed Wall Street and all sorts of things have happened because squirrels and raccoons have, you know, eaten through power cables.
Exactly.
And you've got this infrastructure that was built for a distinctly human purpose being used in a, you know, variety of different ways.
Sorry, I was also going to say a human environment that was built for a particular historical period of time. So, you know, the older parts of the city were built, you know, almost sometimes 400 or 500 years ago when electric infrastructure was not a thing at that point of time. But that's also something which is quite common in Indian cities is the layering of history. So, you know, it's almost a truism, but, you know, you'll often hear historical urban planners in India talk about how there are 9 cities in the city of Delhi or 6 cities in the city of Delhi, right? And each of those cities, insofar as a historian can actually distinguish different parts of these cities, they're also built differently. And so within the same city, you also have simultaneously different historical eras and the infrastructure that is sort of unique to those different unique to those different historical eras. Those either for heritage reasons or more often than not simply because urban governance does not have either the capacity or the will or this profuse corruption to actually deliver to all these different parts of the city. So in which case people just try and make do. So if you look at the oldest parts of the city, the heritage parts of the city, cities that are areas that actually get a lot of tourism because of the heritage value, they tend to be heavily informal in the sense that they are planned by the residents and the citizens and not necessarily by formal governance.
Okay, so this is great because it takes us to the focus of today's episode, which is informality. And I've been trying to think through this a bit about what is informal versus formal and how stark that boundary is between informality and formal. So you've said now a couple of times, you know, citizens or residents doing it for themselves versus formal governance structures. What would formal governance structures be versus, you know, citizens doing it for themselves? If you could give me a tangible example to just help make sense of it.
Yeah, that's a really, really great question. So when we talk about what would formal infrastructure look like, we're actually coming down to the basics of survival and the basics of life itself. So housing, right? So absolute lack of housing. So you would literally have areas. I mean, so in fact, most of the cities of the global south are informal in the sense that, you know, most of them are slum cities. Slums actually are huge proportions of the city. Like the slums are not just marginal in terms of the actual physical area that they occupy. They actually tend to be huge, huge parts of the city. So if you look at the sort of aerial view of Indian cities or cities of the global south more generally, the slums would take over large areas of urban spaces. So informal housing, but some of these informal housing, if you look at some of the slums, some of the oldest slums in India, and there's a slum right in the middle of Mumbai city, for example, which is called Dharavi. It's supposed to be one of Asia's largest slums. Now, it's also one of the oldest slums, and you're talking about generations of families living there. Okay, so if you have generations of families, people that are born into the slum, live in the slum, and grow families in the slum. So, you know, you have intergenerational longevity in these sorts of informal spaces. Mm-hmm. So what happens is that the infrastructure that they build also tends to get more and more permanent and tends to get more and more solidified, so to speak, right? So it is not very easy for formal governance to come in and evict these slums. Oftentimes, yeah. You'll have these slum demolition moves, and they are very controversial, very problematic, because slums, you know, they will literally come with bulldozers and try and break down these slums. But some of these slums just, they're immovable. They're virtually immovable. So there's no other option but for formal dimensions of the city and the informal to coexist. And also these slums also physically are not at the margins of cities. In fact, as you know, through historical time and space, what was marginal, what was sort of, you know, the periphery of urban spaces now become more and more central as cities themselves grow, right? So these slums tend to occupy quite central parts of the city. Sometimes they're called prime real estate, you know, prime real estate that's been given over to the slums. And so that becomes a big concern for property, real estate developers and property developers who would love to put high rises in there, but they can't because there are slums there. So
informal is not necessarily haphazard, because you can build on over generations, and it's not necessarily marginal on the outskirts, because it can be in the center of a city. But does formal mean that it's under municipal government or it's under state governance? So if I as an informal resident someone living in an informal settlement decide to make a plan and create myself a shed and build something in the backyard, maybe I want to keep chickens or something, and this is what I'm doing to make provisions for myself, but I don't get a permit or I don't do anything like that, that's informal. But maybe there's a law or a policy or something that says no chickens allowed in the city. That would be a formal governance.
Yes.
Yeah,
absolutely. So under formal, within formal governance, there would be, it's also called, you can think of formal governance as transactions that occur within the so-called white economy. Okay, so everything is supposedly legal and above board. So the transactions. So if I am paying for electricity, it's legal. It's within the purview of formal governance. So it is supposedly within the ambit of the white economy, right? So that doesn't mean that all informal activities are necessarily illegal. They're just unauthorized. Some of them are just unauthorized. Okay. So there's a distinction. It's a very subtle distinction there. Just because it's unauthorized doesn't necessarily mean it's illegal. Though a lot of them can be illegal, and some of them can actually be even criminal, right? So you'll have slums that are actually spaces of serious criminal activity, underground activity. There is some fantastic urban work that has been done about, slum areas being the hub of terrorism activities as well, because these are so outside of the purview of formal governance, these things can happen. But that doesn't mean that all activities are necessarily illegal or criminal. Though in my work, I did come across these criminal sorts of spaces, so to speak, or illegals, outright illegal spaces, when you're talking about cow butcher houses, for example, or cow slaughter houses. So where these spaces occur, they are not only informal or unauthorized, but they're illegal or criminal in some places.
Okay. So informality, when we're talking about what we've learned here, is almost what it's not necessarily. It's not necessarily illegal. It's not necessarily on the outskirts, and it's not necessarily haphazard, but it's not necessarily authorized either. So exactly. So it's a bit more complicated than than what people often speak about, like formal, informal. It's a lot messier.
Very
but
messy.
You exactly. brought cows in there, and of course this is going to be what we want to talk about today. So now that we have a better understanding of informality, why do you think this is an important concept for thinking about animals and the urban?
Okay, that's such a great question. Thank you so much, Claudia. In general, it is becoming only more and more important to think about animals and the urban in general, right? So, as I said, most of my work does focus on India. But most of my work does focus on India. But if you look at just the global south, the sheer scale of urbanization is so unprecedented that it's common in urban geographical and planning terms to talk about an urban planet, that we are basically now largely an urban planet. And if you look at countries like India or China, by 2050, something like about 500 million Indians are expected to live in cities. And India, together with China, right, will contain a third of the world's urban population, not just the world's population, but the world's urban population. So just these two countries will contain a third of the world's urban population. And this is a massive change. And this is a massive change with obviously local consequences, but also global ecological consequences. And if you take a country like India, India has about 45,000 plant species, about 90,000 animal species, right? And according to the UN Habitat, it's one of the world's most mega-diverse countries. And it's not just India. Most countries are going to be losing their biodiversity significantly due to urbanization. And urbanization, I don't just mean cities. I don't just mean the formation of, you know, formal urban settlements or within the metropolitan limits of what we understand to be cities. But especially in the global south, you also have this new phenomenon, which is becoming really prevalent. And it's a concept called conurbations. So conurbations refer to the regional area, so to speak, between two large cities. Okay, between two large cities that might be quite far away from each other, but these regional hubs, which might have been previously rural or regional or agricultural or forest land, farmland, these areas are becoming thick regions of urbanization itself. Yeah. So between the area between, and this is not just within countries, it's also between countries. So between Calcutta in India and Dhaka in Bangladesh. Dhaka is also a mega city, also a city with an excess of 10 plus million population. The area between Calcutta and Dhaka is a peak conurbation. It's fully urban. And it's not even sometimes very clear when it's between countries as to who is ruling, when you're talking about form governance, it's not even sometimes very clear which country's governance it falls under, leave alone which city's governance, right? So the informality is just increasing exponentially. So it's not just really important to think about the animal and the urban, but I find it helpful, I think, to think about the informal and the urban as well, specifically, because most of these urban spaces are not formally planned. They are informal spaces. Even if you're thinking in purely human terms, they're informal spaces.
Yeah, I mean, cities have a way of kind of manifesting themselves. You know, you build, like you said earlier, you've got cities inside cities, because cities have a way of just like Lego blocks. You put a little here and you put a little there, and all of a sudden you end up with, you know, a structure that wasn't necessarily what you'd imagined to begin with, but you've kind of built something. And this reminds me of something you've mentioned in one of your papers, where you speak about urbanization as being a form of colonization. And I think Claire Palmer also uses this when she talks about urbanization. It's a pity that concept's not going to come up this season, but I think it's quite a provocative idea when you're saying that urbanization is a form of colonization. Could you perhaps tell us a little bit about, in relation to animals at least?
Yeah. So, the idea of urbanization as a form of colonialism is not an original idea from me. I mean, it's been around for a while, but it's useful to think about the urban is a uniquely human concept, right? Animals don't have a concept of urban or rural. I mean, these are human concepts, and these are human concepts that are based on political economies. We consider a space to be an urban space based on the specific unique political economy of that geophysical area, and a rural economy determines that the region is rural. So these are human concepts. And the concept of the urban specifically, there's a world, you know, in the concept of the urban, because it is such a uniquely human concept, the non-human animal typically doesn't have a space in the urban. right? They don't have a space in the urban. But when I say they don't have a space in the urban, of course, there are formal planning protocols, especially in developed cities, that recognize the importance of biodiversity. But at the same time, it's you know, there's a lot of management, there's conservation. So all of these sorts of disciplines and practices, of course, have had ways of trying to think about and theorize about animals in cities. But in the main, animals in cities are either part of a management plan or part of a conservation plan, or they are legitimized possibly by ownership if they are treated as, you know, pets or companion animals. But if outside of these sorts of boundaries, in the main, the non-human animals tenure or residency in the city, so to speak, is constantly precarious. So, and there's a constant level of dispossession and displacement. So when we think about dispossession and we think about colonialism, I think in some ways informality is a useful concept to think about here as well, because it's what we do to poorer humans or vulnerable humans of urban spaces as well, is the evictability, you know, how animals can be constantly evicted. So how they can be constantly dispossessed, how their mobilities is constantly criminalized. Now, mobilities is one of the most important aspects of urban planning when it comes to humans, right? So generally in urban planning theory, it is accepted that the more mobilities that a human has, that a person has, the better their standard of well-being and living. Okay, so for example, if you're living in the inner city and you have access to the tram and the bus and the train, and you also have access to Uber and you have access to your own car and you can walk, you have a wealth of mobilities to choose from. And this freedom of mobilities increases the sense of well-being generally. So the more mobile we can be, better it is for our well-being. It is not very different at all for animals. In species-specific ways, the freedom to be mobile also impacts their well-being, right? But these mobilities are constantly under threat. So, for example, in India, the common, you know, we used to call it the common house sparrow, virtually extinct in urban spaces now. It's because, it's purely because lack of mobility spaces, lack of mobility options, because you have high rises everywhere, you have mobile phone radiation that also interferes with their flying patterns, and absolute lack of roosting spaces. So the modern buildings are these high rises, or they're, you know, glass fronted, and they're quite specifically designed to keep bird life away, as opposed to, you know, older infrastructure, which would, you know, where the birds could still roost and make nests and that sort of thing. That's not really an option anymore. So in fact, along with the state of the environment report, there's actually something called the state of birds report. That also comes out every, I don't know, 5 years or something. But that basically says that the disappearance of birds from urban spaces, and especially these really common birds from urban spaces, is the first sign of environmental problems to come. And we have been having disappearing birds forever now.
I think the concept of mobilities, though, and also mobilities and informality, I think work in an interesting way with one another. Yeah. So, I mean, like, you can't help but reflect on your own personal experiences, right? So I grew up in Johannesburg, has massive informal settlements as well that are born of a racist past and a history that's led to a number of informal mobilities. And one of them being, you know, the taxi system, which has slowly become more and more formalized. But then in terms of thinking about mobility of animals, you know, earlier on you were talking about the monkeys and their mobilities were being impacted on, you know, both by their own precarious position and the fact that they are considered informal or doing things that are not necessarily considered in the formal structure, but they're also being influenced by informal structures. Same thing with the sparrows that you're talking about here what kind of mobility does the city allow for? Yeah. And I assume for some animals, it might improve their mobility and they might find interesting ways to live and do things. But for many others, it might pose a number of challenges.
Yeah. And especially for very terrestrial animals, like, for example, I mean, going back to the street dogs, because they are so profuse and prevalent as a part of Indian urban spaces, right? So if you look, and they're very, very, very terrestrial. Now, most of these dogs, because of diseases, distemper, canine distemper is the most common. You know, there's a range of issues that, and they are unvaccinated, so you know they most of them become vulnerable to disease and death very early on. But the ones that manage to survive, their mobilities are so attuned to the motorized environment. Like, and this is bearing in mind that if you go to any animal shelter, the number of three-legged dogs, semi-paralyzed dogs, because of them being run over is just innumerable. That being said, they are also so aware, so attuned to the urban environment. And I was just amazed in some of the urban informal spaces in a city like Calcutta. Now, Calcutta is one of the most crushingly overcrowded cities that I've ever encountered, even as sort of familiar as I am with extremely overcrowded, high density cities, Calcutta is exceptional. Is exceptional, and I'm talking about the crush of bodies and the crush of vehicles, heavy vehicles, buses, trucks, loading, you know, high load animal, motorized transportation. And I remember I was walking in, you know, on the street. There was really no footpath because, you know, the vehicle, I mean, when you're talking about co-sharing spaces, there's not even a pedestrian footpath, right? So you're basically walking with the traffic and high density traffic and fast moving traffic. They still managed to be fast. And I was walking there and I was feeling really, you know, on edge because I wasn't used to it. And or at least used to that particular space. And I was like trying to be, you know, you get a sense of how vigilant you have to be across. All of your senses are on high alert, basically, is what I would say. Mm-hmm. And in this space, I saw a chicken run into the middle of the space because she found something to eat in the middle of that space. And she was, you know, she was filthy because the constant, layering of soot, dust, oil, all of that in the urban environment is, you know, it's inescapable. And I know for a fact that chickens are like to be very clean because, you know, we have rescued chickens. She was definitely filthy, but she found something there. She was courageous. She had a sense of how quickly to get it and dart back. So I was like amazed, this tiny bird. She could have got crushed in a matter of microseconds and no one would have noticed because, you know, it's a chicken. And I was just amazed at the mobility, at her awareness of the traffic. And we are talking about an ultra-terrestrial animal at that level where everything is thundering above her head.
Wow. So the fascinating thing with talking about Indian cities is I think because you're speaking here about the scale of informality, but also the diversity of animals that you encounter in cities. So far in most of the interviews, we've spoken about dogs, cats actually haven't come up that frequently, but dogs have definitely come up a lot because I think people associate dogs with humans in a very intimate kind of way. But you've been speaking, you know, since the beginning of the episode, you've mentioned a variety of animals from, you know, camels to dogs to sparrows and cows. And now cows are probably, and I know this from my own work, when I tell people I'm doing work on cows and how cows were removed from cities, they're like, but do you know about India? There are cows everywhere in India. Yeah. So it's not just smaller animals that you're finding in Indian cities. You're finding large, I mean, cows are big animals. I didn't realize quite how big a cow was until I stood right next to a cow and realized that her back hips were taller than I was. Yeah. I mean, massive, massive animals.
Yeah.
So have you encountered some cows in the city too?
Yes, to say the least, absolutely. So the political economy around cows is an extremely complex and fascinating one in India. So most of the cows that we see on the streets of India, it's very interesting. Out of all farmed animals, it's interesting that you will predominantly and overwhelmingly only see cows Okay. So despite the fact that, I mean, yes, you would see goats and you would see occasionally pigs, and, you know, it's implicitly understood that they are awaiting slaughter. But in the case of cows, you sort of, it's assumed that they're part of the streets, a part of the street environment. And the interesting, you know, you'll never see buffaloes, for example. You'll never see buffaloes. Buffaloes are an important part of the Indian farmed animal industrial complex, so to speak, but you'll never see buffaloes roaming around on the roads, or you'll never see buffaloes in garbage areas, or, you know, looking through the neighborhood waste. But cows are everywhere. And the reason cows are everywhere is because cows also constitute, obviously, a significant part of India's dairy herd. But most Indian states criminalize their slaughter, okay, in deference to a Hindu sentiment that regards cows as sacred, or cows as mother, etc. Mm-hmm. So the reason why there are so many cows in urban spaces specifically, though, is because there's also lots of urban dairies. Now, these are interesting because urban dairies, in the main, are illegal. You shouldn't really be having urban dairies in increasingly most cities have criminalized. They're called tabelas locally. But most of these tabelas or urban dairies are regarded by urban municipal areas as unauthorized. So they should actually be outside of city limits. Except that there's so many urban customers who want fresh milk. So, you know, there's illegal dairies everywhere. And we're talking about buildings which might have, you know, they'll be literally buildings filled with cows. I have seen spaces where there are like 17 cows in the tiniest of spaces, these hot, steamy places. They'll never see the light of day. So you'll have these urban dairies that are so profusely illegal and so profusely overcrowded, unlike anything I've ever seen, actually. So some of the most problematic spaces in terms of dairies I've seen are actually urban spaces, and they're tightly bound, confined, and that's how they're going to stay until they no longer milk, they no longer get pregnant. It's time to move them through the dairy production continuum towards their slaughter. Now, illegal dairies in urban spaces automatically also means there's illegal cow slaughterhouses in urban spaces, right? So, and not only are...
And isn't slaughter in general, isn't that an illegal, or is that just there's a specific geography to where or how cows can be slaughtered in India, isn't it?
Right. So it's illegal in most states. So some states don't. In fact, there's, you know, the whole idea of a legal cow slaughterhouse is such a novel one in India. There's only about two or three states that actually have licensed cow slaughterhouses in India. So that's the state of West Bengal and in Kerala, because they are ruled by communist states. And so they don't have laws that you know, specifically regard the cow as sacred, because that's a Hindu concept. So because they're communist ruled states, they have licensed legal cow slaughterhouses, and they always have had. So what a lot of the other states do, a lot of the other major dairy producing states of the north, like Gujarat, or, I mean, within their own state, in the state of Gujarat, for example, if it's a state in Western India, which is where our current Prime Minister Modi comes from, cow slaughter can be punished by life imprisonment. And in fact, they actually want cow slaughter to be punished with capital punishment, like with hanging, right? So that's what they're lobbying for. But it's, at the moment, it's life imprisonment for slaughtering cows. But you constantly...
And this isn't for other animals.
Sorry?
This is just cows. This isn't for other animals. You can kill a pig, you can kill a chicken, there's no concern. But cows are imbued with a whole bunch more politics.
Yeah, the cow body is one of the most political bodies in India. Extremely political. So, so while they have these laws within their own state, there are, first of all, any number of illegal slaughterhouses in just about every single state in the country. But you'll also have trucks that move through these spaces containing literally hundreds of bodies of cows that are trafficked in really brutal conditions. We're talking about live cows that are trafficked in really brutal conditions and then taken to these other states where cow slaughter is legal. So,
I mean, you showed me a picture yesterday that had it was three, possibly even four cows jammed into the boot of a car, which it seems, I mean, they were smaller. They seemed like they were probably calves, yeah. Young cows of sorts, but still the idea of such large, I mean, it's terrible enough that they're going to be slaughtered, but, you know, how we were speaking about mobilities earlier, this makes me think about how informality works on both different humans and different people, because as the practice of dairying and slaughter is informal, yeah. And illegal,
yeah.
it compels certain behaviors that result in really bad situations for cows.
Absolutely, absolutely. And and there's two things to this, right? So one is, you know, Dinesh Vadivel talks about this in his work on animals and capitalism, but he basically talks about how mobilities, and you're talking about farmed animals here, how mobilities or transportation, I think he frames this in terms of transportation, but how transportation from one animal site to another animal site is crucial to add value to the animal body, okay? So you're moving the prepubescent chicks from the, you know, from here to the egg farm, and then from there they move to the slaughterhouse. So every time, or especially in the case of pigs, from the farrowing crates to the sow crates, to then they are, you know, in those, you know, those large, extremely confined spaces. So every time you move an animal from one site to the other, that is that movement, that transportation is really important to add value to the entire chain. That's what the transportation from one site to another is what keeps the commodity, the animal commodity, viable, sustainable, and profitable. Now, in the case of India, the movement of the cows from the dairy farm to the slaughterhouse is legally criminal. It's a criminal activity because you're not supposed to slaughter cows. So what happens is this part of the movement, we must still, I mean, you know, the cold economic logics of dairying require that India also slaughter ex-dairy cows. I mean, India is not unique or exceptional to this sort of pure economics of dairying, right? Mm-hmm. But this particular aspect of transportation that Dinesh Vadivel talks about, you know, adding value, transportation from one site to another, adding value. Now, the transportation to the slaughterhouse in the case of India must occur underground. It must be concealed. It must occur in the sort of, you know, black economy, so to speak. And it's often done, it is usually done by highly precarious racialized communities, like, you know, poor Muslims or poor Dalits. They are the ones who are, in India, it's not just, you know, dirty labor, it's really risky labor, because you could get killed or lynched for, you know, if you're discovered with, and it has happened several times in the last few years, that you'll find, you know, Muslims or Dalits being lynched to death or killed or raped or whatever for transporting these cars. So it's really problematic on that end. The other thing is, you know, what we're talking about, I think the example that you mentioned about the cows that were taken in a single car, or sometimes you will find, you know, those auto rickshaws, those three-wheeler transportations in India, you'll find even you know, packed with four or five cows, for example, they're small animals, they can easily be fitted in. You'll find one car taking one cow. And you would, and this sounds like this is so crazy, because normally in the West, you would find trucks containing a large number of animals, right? 50, 60, 100, 200 animals, whatever, right? And they are taken in one cohesive truck, so to speak. In India, you have those trucks, which are absolutely jam-packed with animals, you know, broken legs, whatever, but they are just, and some of them are quite literally dead at the time of loading. So you do have those trucks, but you also have these sorts of micro-mobility, so to speak, like one auto rickshaw or one car. Okay. Sometimes you would even have you know, motorbikes carrying you know, with a car for something strapped to the motorbike. Now, but this is not this per se. This sort of micro labor, micro mobilities per se is actually characteristic of informality. So that's not per se unique. That's how informality works. Informality does work in terms of micro labor, but together. Together, all of these individual single units, they're all actually crucial to oiling the transportation economy of cow slaughter in India. But together, they actually contribute to an industrial scale of cow slaughter. So we have nothing less than an industrial scale of cow slaughter, which occurs predominantly, overwhelmingly in the informal or illegal economy, the black economy or even. But that happens through these micromobilities, one car, one scooter, one, but when you have hundreds and thousands of these, they together contribute to an industrial scale of cow slaughter.
I mean, yeah, you spoke in your paper about how, I mean, so this raises for me a couple of things, because you've got dairying happening in the city that's, you know, as any person who I think is familiar with either animal rights or animal studies knows that there's an intimate connection between dairy and slaughter. That if you're drinking milk, you're also related to the slaughter of cows.
That's right. Like,
these are not unrelated industries. But you've got in the city itself, you've got, you've spoken about like white and black economies here.
Yeah.
And I know in your paper, you also speak about white and black spaces and gray spaces. And perhaps we can talk about that in a minute. But you've got what are white economies. And the language, I really want to understand why it's white, black, and gray. But you've got white economies.
I know.
I was like, it feels wrong somehow to be saying like the legitimate stuff is white and the illegitimate stuff
absolutely. It's a very racialized language. It is common in informal studies to use this kind of framing. But when we get to gray spacing, I think it is helpful to think about it in terms of the blurring, because gray helps to blur the black and white. But you're right in that. And I've always noticed it and felt uncomfortable with it as well. We need to find new ontological terms.
Well, it's not black or white. It could also be a chess term, I guess. It could be, you know, black and white are opposing colors. I guess it's just because these are high intensity times when oftentimes that color gets associated with negative and the other with positive impurity.
Absolutely.
So I think it's
absolutely.
So, but I mean, with that in mind, just so that we're aware of that tension there, but you're saying that you've got, you know, white or legitimate economies, dairies happening in the city, but you've also got illegitimate ones that shouldn't be happening or cows. Or was it a matter of cows are allowed in the city, but there are illegitimate dairies happening?
So
do you have both?
So here,
sorry if that's not clear.
No. I understand what you're trying to say. So dairying, for example, per se is legal, but where it occurs might be unauthorized or illegal. Okay, but dairying per se is not illegal. You're allowed to have cows for dairying. Slaughtering, where it occurs, is illegal. Right.
Okay, so you've got what is a legitimate economy that sometimes takes place in illegitimate spaces in the city, connected to a wholly illegitimate economy that often is removed and taken outside of the city.
That's right. So you have within cities, for example, you have so gray spaces generally. Okay, and this is more broadly related to urban spaces, right? I mean, to informal studies more broadly, like just taking one step back from the animals at this point. As I said, informality doesn't necessarily refer exclusively to illegality or criminal activities. And it also doesn't necessarily only refer to the poor either. Like the privileged, wealthier citizens of urban spaces can be engaging in informal activities as well. Like, for example, if I were to take a guitar and start sort of strumming it on the street corner and, you know, people want to donate money to me, that's an informal activity too, right? So informality generally depends on the space. It depends on the time. Okay, so even within the same day, certain activities can be more informal than the other. And informality refers to the social sort of spaces, the social conditioning, the social elements of space. Now, informality can, you know, so private, in India, for example, you'll have any number of extremely wealthy people constructing unapproved houses or using land in unapproved ways. Like they'll have these huge McMansions on land that is not even theirs, right? So it's really common. So it's not necessarily something that only the poor do, because when so much of urban governance is not formal, or if it is corrupt, because corruption can also cause these sorts of blurring of what is legitimate and what is not. The wealthier, the rich people can actually take advantage just as much of whatever gray economies can offer. Right. So most of it is not necessarily illegal or criminal, although a lot of it is. So that's considered gray. Right. So, okay. I mean, so this is actually a concept that Israeli urban planner Oren Yiftichel, he comes up with this concept of gray spaces. So gray spaces, he says, talks about, you know, he talks about developments. He talks about populations. He talks about transactions that are within the sort of light spaces of you know, we can call it light spaces of legality, whatever is illegal, etc. So gray spaces refers to those spaces that blur these distinctions between, you know, authorized, illegal, and legal. And it exists, and this is really important. And I'm quoting him here. He says it exists partially outside the gaze of state authorities and city plans. It's not that they are unaware of it. It exists partially out of. So this is a case of formal governance looking at these activities and transactions from the corner of their eyes. They know it, but if I don't know it, I don't have to do anything about it. Do you know what I'm saying? So less I know, better it is for you. So the movement of cows, for example, from dairy farms to slaughterhouses, from these sort of, when I say dairy farms, I don't mean those bucolic green hills even. I'm talking about those cramped dairying spaces that are common in Indian cities, you know, where you have these absolute bodies jammed into these tiny rooms. But moving cows, for example, moving cows, transporting cows, just the simple fact of transporting cows from point A to point B is a really good example of a gray activity. Because transporting cows per se is not illegal, right? You could be transporting cows because you're taking them to a dairy farm, or you bought some cows and you're taking them to a farm, or I'm taking them to the vet, or, you know, there could be any number of reasons why I need to move cows. And that doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to take them to the slaughterhouse. So the intention is not clear. If the intention is not clear, that falls into the gray spaces. That falls into a gray activity. And most slaughtering happens, most of the slaughter transportation happens in the gray economy.
So gray is this, like, I like the idea of like blurred spaces or blurred, you know, where it's not clear, you know, what side of things. It's a messier space. Yes. It's a space but I like, you know, the idea of, you said that the officials or the authorities often know that this is happening, and they know it out of the corner of their eyes. And this makes me think in an earlier episode, I spoke to Paula Akari about invisibilized animals.
Yeah.
And she was also speaking about mobility, but for her, she was speaking about how animals that are mobile, often moving through cities and in massive transportation trucks, etc., upon who cities are reliant, urbanites eat, wear, but the animals themselves are grossly invisible, right? They actually, the extent to which humans in these cities, or some humans in these cities, make kind of connections between commodities and animals is really rare. You know, someone will eat a steak or drink a glass of milk without necessarily making a connection that there is a cow behind this product.
Right.
Whereas I think gray activities or gray spaces is not, you could have the same animals, but they're not invisibilized. It's not as though these animals are not seen.
Yeah.
They're seen, they've got a legitimate space in society, but the activities with which they're engaged are not as clear cut. It's not as simple as this or that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But this also depends on the type of animal, again, because if you were transporting goats or pigs in Indian cities, I expect it would be very similar to what Paula Akari was talking about, that the animal themselves are invisible, or they are so completely reduced to the commodity that they represent, like the sheep is a mutton or pig is just, you know, pork or whatever, that the animal can remain invisibilized. In the case of cows, they're hypervisible as well. They're hypervisible because they don't just embody economic capital, they embody political capital as well.
Yeah.
Right? So they're hypervisible. Wow, this has been hypervisible as political capital.
Yeah, so and that's a really important distinction. Is different animals can have, you know, there are a multitude of relations and practices that happen within different cities. I mean, the same species can be undergoing the same animal. One individual animal can move between these different kinds of practices over the course of their life, which is important to keep in mind. So coming back to the idea of informality then and animal studies, I mean, I just think this is a really powerful concept for animal studies and anyone interested in doing urban work is to, I mean, one, you said it's really important. A lot of animal studies has focused, I think, in general on cities either in the global north or in India. I think Indian cities and cities in the global north have received quite a bit of attention. And there's a lot of really great theory coming out of work that's being done in Indian cities. But when you start to think about how huge, you know, the global south is and how different discourses, I think, are in terms of what animals' relationships are with cities in global south cities versus global north cities, this idea of informality is really important. Because, yes, we're talking about cows here in India where they're highly politicized. But I know, for example, in Kenya, they're now trying to start a new program of bringing people into the city because Africa is the fastest urbanizing space in the world. Not in terms of the numbers you were talking about earlier, but certainly
in terms of the land,
incredibly fast.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. But now they're being encouraged to bring animals with them into the city as a matter of development. So it's those animals being brought into the cities are being part of like a development discourse, whereas you're not seeing that necessarily in global north cities. But sorry, I'm going on a I'm going on a tangent.
You're absolutely right. But I think there are common strands, whether you're talking about the global south or not. So I think there are common important strands when you're talking, and informality becomes for me a very useful concept, because if you're talking about you know, animals are seen. They're not necessarily, but they're seen as powerless or weak, or, you know, or they're seen in criminalized terms, not necessarily criminal, but criminalized. So they might be pests or trespassers or scavengers. I mean, you know, you have these other terminologies that depict their unwanted or criminalized status. But informality, I find that to be helpful, because informality doesn't just blur illegal, legal. It doesn't just blur who is, you know, legitimate or a citizen and who is not. It doesn't just blur what is, you know, a permanent structure versus a temporary one. It doesn't just blur these sorts of binaries. It also, for me, I think it's really important, it blurs the human and non-human as well. Because we have so far used informality only to think about intra-human binaries, right? The rich and the poor, or the legal, he's illegal and he's legal and he's illegal, or, you know, we always talk about informality mainly in terms of intra-human binaries, the binaries that we create within the human sort of cohort itself. But biologically, we are, of course, animals as well. But the sorts of multi-species blurring of co-sharing human, non-human spaces have never not happened, basically, right? They've constantly happened. But also, as you were talking about in the case of Africa, so too in other cities of the global south, right? Like you'll constantly have, and in the north, you'll have cities that are predating, cannibalizing its, you know, the outer peripheries, the outer regions, and they're becoming bigger and bigger and bigger and larger geospatially. They're becoming larger and larger. Now, for example, in Mumbai, there is a protected natural reserve, which is close to the city, very close to the city. And the city has basically encroached into the national reserve, right? Now, you have a situation in Mumbai which is so surreal. Mumbai city has close to 200 leopards that live in the city of Mumbai.
Yeah, I've seen the footage.
Yeah, let's live in the city of Mumbai.
It's one of the biggest populations of leopards in the world.
Yes, exactly.
Is actually in a city, which is...
Exactly. And if you think about Mumbai, geospatially, it's like Manhattan. It's an island. Okay, so you have this extraordinary density of humans and like some 200 leopards. And you know, if you look at the footage, because this work is really fascinating. If you look at the footage of leopards and you go to a leopard expert and try and tell them to interpret what they see, these leopards are not shrinking. These leopards are not scared. They are moving quite confidently through these urban spaces. I mean, they are mainly mobile at night, which is typical of cats in general. But they are walking confidently. Like the leopard's not. I mean, the confidence indicates that these are not only familiar territory to them. In the leopard's worldview, mm-hmm. this is their territory. Okay, so you have...
And they're navigating it.
So most of this footage is now sort of, you know, available on through CCTV cameras, and because these have become very common. But at nighttime, you'll find leopards navigating the city so casually. And yet they manage to keep themselves hidden from, you know, from the eye mm-hmm. in the main. Now, how, you know, they cope, they have found their niches where they can hide themselves in this hyperdense city. They have found niches where they can hide themselves. They have learned mainly that it is safest to feed on the stray dogs, on the street dogs. Okay,
yeah, going after I've seen some of that footage.
Yeah, going after a human is, you know, it could lead to trouble, but that happens. But most of the time they go after this, after street dogs. They sometimes go after cows and chickens as well, which again alerts people to their presence. But dogs, no one really notices because there's so many. So you have these sorts of spaces. Now, you know, it's really interesting when we talk about, I mean, a leopard is an extreme case because it's also seen as a predatory animal, a real risk mm-hmm. to human lives, etc. But in the main, like, animals live with us. And in one of my other papers, I talk about this whole idea of post-human cosmopolitanism. Like, you know, cosmopolitanism we think about as inclusive of racial diversity, religious diversity, gender diversity. We're talking about an actual celebration of diversity. But we're talking about multicultural diversity at its fullest, you know. And in fact, we rank cities highly based on how cosmopolitan they are. So one of, you know, so Melbourne constantly gets sort of noted for being one of the world's most livable cities, for example. And one of the reasons it is celebrated as such is because of its cosmopolitan nature. But what if we were to sort of, you know, stretch this notion of cosmopolitanism to multi-species as well, you know, really stretch it to multi-species diversity.
There's so much interesting stuff you've said there, though. Like, you think about leopards, dogs, chickens, humans, how there are different, you spoke about niches, the different relationships are literally forming. Mm. And the extent to which, I mean, they should be celebrated or problematized, I guess, is still open for discussion. But like you said, I mean, again, raising informality, they have to at least be noted and viewed as legitimate relations first, right? So the relationship between the leopard and the dog is mostly on the fringes, I guess, of what people are thinking about in terms of cities. And the only reason either the leopard or the dog comes into human formal governance structures is to say, okay, well, they've become a problem. How do we, you used the word earlier on in the interview, how do we evict them? They've become, so yeah, it's really fascinating. But sorry, I cut you off there. You were saying, like, imagine if we stretch, instead of multiculturalism, like multi-speciesism.
Because, you know,
it'd be a fascinating.
What formal planning tries to do is you know, it's formal governance generally is all about management in some ways, right? But informality indicates, not, you know, even in the human cases, it indicates people and spaces that are outside of this sort of management, that they have their own agency, that have their own innovation. And animals, I think, kind of very easily fall into that cohort because, you know, they're not going to mm-hmm. obey, and they don't even know to, because, you know, their notions of territory are so unique to, you know, they're so species specific, right? So informality gives us this sort of really good template to think about yielding control, while at the same time, I mean, again, this is, you know, going back to work that's being done with the intrahuman level as well, yielding control, but at the same time ensuring some rough level of protection is still available to these people. Right. Yeah. And what that can look like. And that's again, I think in the context of animals, because you have such a huge range of species, that will become a really an interesting, but also a very complex political challenge, because ultimately even when we try and make it multi-species and even when we try and make it inclusive, ultimately it is humans who are sort of driving so much of these frameworks.
Yep. But like you say, though, is if you start to embrace the idea, I guess, of informality and innovation and seeing animals as being, I mean, this is, I think some of these ideas come up in ecological circles, certainly. But I think when you start to, informality is a bit more political and it's a bit more urban oriented. When you start to say, okay, this is an informal relation happening, but it's a stabilized one, or it's one that shouldn't just be, you know, cast aside as being irrelevant or not necessary. It's an important part of the city.
Yeah.
You know, you spoke about generation upon generation of informal, you know, residents,
yeah.
Informal settlement residents,
yeah.
Learning and creating new strategies and new infrastructures.
Yeah.
I think animals in cities are also generation on generation,
absolutely,
creating new infrastructures, creating new relationships. And when we start to view informality and animals extending informality, you know, not just beyond, like you've disrupted it a couple of times in this interview, you know, saying it's not just about poor people, it's not just about illegality, it's about seeing the stuff that happens between the lines, right?
Absolutely.
And I think it's fascinating. It's so exciting.
Yeah.
But Yamini, we are literally at an hour already. And normally by now I'm saying, thank you so much. It's been lovely talking to you. But I feel like you and I'm trying to stop myself. I keep saying the same like catchphrases in every episode. But before we get too carried away, could you possibly read us your quote? I'm sure we're going to have some more to say about that.
Okay, great. I'll try. So just to give you a bit of context about this quote, this is from my book, which is currently under review. It's provisionally entitled Mother Mary. Yeah. and this is about this sort of, you know, the phenomenon of male calves in the male dairy calves in urban spaces. So what happens a lot of times is that, you know, you have these male calves that are often donated to temples. Because, you know, dairy farmers think, oh, the Hindu temples are supposed to take care of them. And then the temples will actually oftentimes sell them back door to slaughterhouses. Hindu temples will do that, right? That's very common. So the route to the slaughterhouse is often through Hindu temples. And it's quite prevalent, but again, it's one of those things that, you know, are often misseeing. So this is just my description of some calves that I've noticed outside of a temple. So the deep red puttu is the the red dot that's often on the forehead that often signals Hindu communities, right? The deep red puttu smeared across the forehead of the small male Jersey calf had started to bleed in the rain, appearing as a premonition of a dark gash slicing his face. He stood still patiently with three other males at the foot of the 1,000 steps that marked the ascent to the Simhachalam temple in Vishakhapatnam city in Andhra Pradesh. Vishakhapatnam is the second most venerated Hindu temple in the state, which in turn is regarded as one of the holiest Hindu sites in the world. Each calf was decorated with a garland of drenched flowers and holy tulsi or basil leaves and glittery red ribbons. Following a cramped ride in the backseat of an auto rickshaw or even a long trek from a village, in the peri-urban areas of Vishakhapatnam, these newborn males from India's dairy sector would be transformed briefly as gods in being donated by their owners to Simhachalam. Ribs protruded prominently from the sides of each calf. One small calf caught scent of my extended hand and desperately suckled it for a couple of minutes before turning his small head away in disappointment. He did not even yet have teeth. At the end of each day, a transfer truck from an animal shelter would take the orphan Jersey calves away to a few acres of greenery, where they would join other rescued calves, their numbers increasing daily. Up to 40% of the youngest calves will die without their mother's colostrum and body warmth. These are the lucky males. Until a few years ago, they were being auctioned en masse by the temple on a weekly basis to intermediaries who would route them to slaughterhouses. That's it.
So sad.
And this is how the informal economy works. And this is a great example again of gray spacing, because you wouldn't expect Hindu temples to be part of the continuum from dairy farm to slaughterhouse. So when I bring my male calf, who is obviously a waste product of the dairy industry, when I take him to a Hindu temple, it's not immediately questionable, you know, it's the purpose is not very clear, as I said. It's
yeah.
I'm taking him to a temple and presumably the temple will take care, but then the temple auctions them.
But yeah, and you've got to assume that the person who's donating the calf somewhat knows, you know, they know.
Everybody knows, yes.
What also stands out for me in that quote, though, is that you spoke about Jersey cows. And Jersey cows are, I think, considered to be a Western cow. And this makes it takes me back to in season one, I spoke to Charlotte Blattner. You know, we spoke a little bit about how these economies, they're not just cities and not just nations, but they cut across nations. You've got, you know, you've got cows moving between countries. You know, what happened recently with the cows being stranded on the ships in the Straits.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So these are Jersey cows, so they're not indigenous to India. India has a whole bunch of indigenous cows. So I assume that you know, I heard you give a talk at Apple last week.
Yes,
where
yes.
You was it last week?
Yeah.
I don't know. The time is really weird right now. Recently, but you spoke a little bit about this with, you know, Jersey cows versus is it Brahmin?
Native indigenous cows. Mm-hmm. So these cows as well, I think, you know, so when we talk about informality in terms of populations as well, like not developments, but also mm-hmm. populations, because certain, you know, you have illegal citizens or non-legal citizens or unauthorized residents, etc. So Jersey calves also fall, I think, within that sort of parameter of what we can think about as, you know, sort of grave residents, because in India, cows per se, as per the law of the land, cows per se have protection from slaughter in most states. Mm-hmm. So the laws don't make a distinction between breeds of cows. But informally, people who are working in informal dairies, but even formal dairies, people who are having to deal with the issue of the male calf or the unwanted dairy animals, which is as prevalent in India as in any other dairy economy, they have mm-hmm. to make these sorts of ontological distinctions about who is a legal citizen and who is not a legal citizen. So in this respect, the Jersey, who is not native to India, who is foreign to India, is seen as not legitimate or not a legitimate citizen or an appropriate citizen for having the advantage of these cow protection laws. So they are killable, so to speak.
Would a Brahmin calf who's donated to this temple also go through these same informal, or would they be kept as part of the sanctuary? Would they be continually revered, or would they also, just by virtue of their gender, I mean, I guess now we're also seeing intersectionality, where you come from, but also what your gender what your gender means for you?
Absolutely. So as I was mentioning earlier, informality very much depends on the time that these events occur. So previously, because right now we have a very Hindu nationalist government in place, so the interpretation is in keeping with the realities of the political situation in India, right? Previously, all cows were easily shunted off to slaughter. So they would the temple would receive cows of all breeds, including native breeds. And because, you know, native breeds are as disposable for dairying, if you're looking at purely the dairy economy, and they would all get disposed of for slaughter. But now that we have a Hindu nationalist state in place that explicitly has cow protection as its political agenda, they now need to make this distinction, this ontological distinction between Jersey cow, native cow. Okay? Mm-hmm. Because we just can't afford to have every cow being saved if you are to have a viable dairy industry. So who can we dispose of? Well, let's dispose of the Jerseys. They're not even from India. They're not even Hindu, so to speak. Mm-hmm. They're not Hindu cows. So the idea of cows per se having a religion is such a surreal one.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for all of this. I think informality is just such a, you know, you've provided it. I mean, what a rich concept, not only in terms of thinking through the city, but spaces in the city, populations in the city, relationships, practices. I think we've covered a whole gambit here today. It's been awesome. My brain always, I have these interviews, I'm like, I got to go sit down and write. It's so stimulating and great. So thank you so much. But before I let you go, could you possibly just let us know, you mentioned that there's a book. Could you let us know what you're currently working on and if people are interested in what you're doing, how they can get in touch with you?
So it's very easy to get in touch with me. I think my email is y.narayanan@deakin.edu.au, and my profile is available through the Deakin University website. I'm currently working on a very interesting aspect of informal economies, which is the brick economy, the construction, the production of bricks, which is almost fully taking place in the informal economy, not just in India, but almost all of South Asia. And there is this extraordinary cocktail of intersections of child labor, animal labor, human rights violations in these sorts of sites. So it's one of the largest informal economies in South Asia is the brick production economy, and I think that's the focus of my upcoming work.
Wow, it's so interesting. Like, you take a simple thing and you think, okay, let me start unpacking the relationships around a brick and around a pencil and around something that seems every day, and you start to just realize how complex it is and how opaque it is.
Absolutely.
That sounds fascinating.
Absolutely. How political and, everything is, yes.
And the book that's in, you said the quote that you just gave us, the book is now under review?
The book is under review. It's provisionally titled Mother Dairy. I'm not sure if that title will continue or not, but yeah, it's under review, and hopefully it'll be out in, I don't know, a year or so, depending on how the review and production process goes.
Well, let us know when it's out.
Absolutely.
And I'm very, very, very excited to read it. But for now, I just wanted to say thank you so much for joining me on the show. It's been a pleasure talking to you and learning from you. And I look forward to continued conversations.
It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, Claudia. It always is. It always is. It's such fun talking to you. And I can't wait for the next time.
So in this episode, we spoke a fair bit about cows, and I thought, why not bring them a bit more into focus by looking at cows for the animal highlight? Now, in the last animal highlight, we spoke about chickens, and I think for most people, they can understand and appreciate the chickens are fairly small, and them being in the city is perfectly understandable. But for many folks, I think in North America and in Europe in particular, the idea of cows in the city seems a bit strange, absurd even. You know, there might be one or two outliers where they think, oh, but there are cows in Cambridge, the Cambridge Commons, for example. But actually, for many, the idea of a cow walking down the street would seem really odd. And many people will then defer to, I think, Indian cities and say, well, India is a really great example of where cows are in cities. And you're not wrong. There are many, many cows in Indian cities, and there are many cows in a lot of cities, in fact, around the world. But the reason I wanted to focus on cows in this animal highlight is also to draw attention to the fact that even in urban areas where you can't see an animal, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're not urban animals, right? So in North American cities, for example, just because there are no cows walking down the street, it doesn't mean that they aren't in intimate relationship with that urban area. And of course, the most obvious relationship is them being consumed as meat, milk, leather. Just by virtue of them being what Catherine Gillespie calls afterlives is an indicator of them being urban animals, but perhaps not in the lively way that we've been speaking about urban animals. But this is not to say that there are no urban cow relations either. There are tons of very different urban cow relations. There are the urban cow relations that Yamini spoke about in the episode, where we see cows being revered while at the same time being embroiled and entangled in both dairy and meat industries, where they're found in a variety of different spaces, including on streets and in sanctuaries. But there are also urban relationships with cows in places where you might not expect. So, for example, in Spain, the Pamplona Bull Run, there are tons of bulls that have to engage in and participate in these runs. And what does this mean for the bulls themselves? It's a historical event. How do they experience running through the streets with crowds of people shouting at them? A new and one that I think is quite interesting as well with the last concept where we spoke about urban metabolism is the floating farm in Rotterdam. So there's a new farm in Rotterdam. It has 35 cows, and it's all being done in the name of climate change and sustainable development, where the people who have developed these farms say, well, having 35 cows here who produce manure that is then put in the city, and they help us to fertilize, the farm so that vegetables can grow. It's a very attractive idea, but I've got to admit it makes me feel a little bit uncomfortable, because how could this possibly be scaled up? What does it mean for cows and the way they experience urban life? What are their relationships with their babies? And there are tons of other urban examples, right? The cows being used in protests in Ottawa, where the dairy industry was protesting the price, milk price hikes. And this has happened tons of times, right? Cows are constantly brought into urban areas with their milk poured down streets as symbols for what it means to increase the price of milk. But again, what does this mean for the cows themselves when they are brought into cities, when they're used as these kinds of symbols? All of these examples, to me, point to the fact that cows are urban animals. And this is not even to mention or talk about how historically ubiquitous they were in urban areas. Do yourselves a favor and go and check out some images of the Union Stockyards, just to get a sense of how many cows, the kind of, and the Union Stockyards here is particularly large, but to get a sense of just how many animals, how many cows have historically been in North American cities. And just as a way of a reminder, many of the things that I speak about in these animal highlights, I try to find some videos to make it a little bit more accessible. And you can find those videos on the Animal Turn YouTube channel. And there's a playlist with season 3 animal highlights. But I also think that I try to use these highlights not to just raise questions about the theme, which is animals in the urban, but also to think about the animals themselves and to highlight them. That's why it's an animal highlight, after all. And cows, despite cows being animals that I think everyone around the world knows, many people don't know a lot about cows. One of the first words that I think English speakers learn is cow. Children love cows, but we don't know a lot about them as animals instead of as commodities. So here are a couple of things to help drive home who cows are and some of their cool social quirks. So when they're allowed to form their own social bonds, cows like to live in matriarchal herds. They have female leaders. They form very strong social bonds. Cows as mothers are really fantastic moms who love their calves. And they have best friends. There's been research that's been done to try and figure out if cows have friendships, which obviously they do. But not only do they have friends, they have best friends. They have cows that they prefer to spend their time with and hang out with. They're extremely curious and social animals. If you've ever had the chance to watch some videos of cows playing with balls, there's one in particular of a cow playing with a Pilates ball where she's running and she's jumping and she's snorting and just clearly happy and wonderful. And seeing a cow run and how high they can jump, I mean, it just blows my mind. Something else you might not know is that cows' ancestors, their ancient ancestors, are called aurochs. These were massive animals with huge horns. They tended to weigh well over a ton. And in fact, most cows are supposed to or were naturally meant to have horns, but because of different breeding and that kind of stuff, many cows today are born without horns, and that's called polled or polled cattle. I tend to use the word cow instead of cattle. This is following the work of Catherine Gillespie, because cattle is also tied etymologically to both the concepts of property and capital. So I don't want to think of cows as property and capital, even though these are the structures they live in. So I tend towards using the colloquial word cows instead of cattle. And one final interesting tidbit for you is that there are many, 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 many different breeds of cows. In fact, there are over 1,400 different breeds of cows. 184 of them are extinct and 490 of them are currently on the endangered or at-risk list. So that's because there are a very small handful of cows that have been used and bred again and again to be used in our industries, such as the iconic Holstein with black and white fur. And every time you drink a glass of milk in an urban area or you see a milk advert, chances are that milk has come from a Holstein, because Holsteins make up the vast majority of the global dairy herd. And I'm speaking of the upper 90s percentile. So these are just some interesting things to know about cows. I've mentioned Holsteins, who are one of the most ubiquitous and widespread cows around the world. How about mentioning a cow that many people might not have known about, and that's called the Ankole, A-N-K-O-L-E. I absolutely love this cow. beautiful, massive horns, just absolutely gorgeous. They come from, or you can find them in Uganda. Definitely check out some pictures of Ankole. They are just absolutely beautiful. So the next time you think about a cow, I wouldn't think of them as being simple animals. They've got extremely long histories dating back to at least 15,000 years. There are hundreds of different types of breeds, thousands of different types of stories, and many, 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 many urban relationships for us to understand. All right. So I just want to say thank you once again to Yamini Narayanan for being a fantastic guest, to Jeremy John for the logo, and Gordon Clark for the bed music. As always, a huge thank you to Animals and Philosophy, Politics, Law and Ethics, Apple, for sponsoring this podcast. Apple gives me a little bit of money per episode, which is really helpful. It helps me to kind of get up on Buzzsprout and to get my Zencaster, which is where I do the recording. It doesn't, you know, pay the bills or anything, but it really, really helps me to make sure that this podcast functions and operates. I'm slowly starting to explore some other sponsorship opportunities or avenues, such as maybe reaching out to research groups to sponsor particular seasons, or, you know, getting on Patreon or something like that, because I really want to produce more content. So if you've got any sponsorship ideas, let me know, because that's what I'm busy figuring out. It's the next step in the podcast's evolution. But that's it for me for this time. Thank you for spending your time with me today. This is The Animal Turn with me, Claudia Herzenfelder.
For more great iRaw podcasts, visit iRawPod.com. That's IROARPOD.com.